Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with physiotherapist Zach Couples. Zach and I speak about what role breath plays for biomechanics, whether we should train through pain, what mistakes you might be making with your split squats, and more. I hope you enjoy the episode, and please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Zach. Zach Couples, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
I'm truly excited to speak with you today, and I would love to start us off with simply asking the question, what is the number one thing you are excited for our listeners to take away from this conversation today?
I'm excited for them to appreciate how they can use very simple exercises and something that we fundamentally do on a regular basis, breathing, to improve their overall mobility, so they can continue to push themselves for longer without running into any walls.
I love that because I think we all aim to live healthy, long lives, not just a long life, full stop, especially if we have families who we want to serve for longer or be with for longer, and just in general, to enjoy life also, obviously. Great answer. And I'm excited to dig deeper into that. But before we do, tell me how you got into physiotherapy.
So I was always an athlete growing up, I played basketball, and then eventually I moved towards cross country and track. And I did that competitively at the collegiate level. And I've always been interested in trying to be better at that. And so one of my coaches in high school was a chiropractor. And so that got me a little bit into some of the movement and training side of things. I spent a lot of time learning that. Like I was reading, you know, running textbooks in high school. And then when I got to college, I'm like, oh, I'm not that good because everyone's really fast now. So I need to do other things to get better. And that's when I really dove into the movement piece, and I ended up falling more in love with that. And then eventually I observed at a physical therapy clinic and worked at one, and that really kind of set me in motion to becoming a PT. And then things really cascaded in terms of doing what I do now when I did a clinical affiliation with my mentor, Bill Hartman, who's one of the best PTs I've ever seen. Just seeing how he could take someone who's got a specific problem and provide a more holistic and global strategy to help that person get better was profound, and it's something that stuck with me and allowed me to develop a lot of the things that I do to help people do the same.
Yeah, it's amazing because from what I see is you don't just help one-on-one persons, but you also have a wonderful seminar. I believe it's called Human Matrix. Is that correct? Yes. I'm excited to talk more about that, where you help other trainers improve the quality of their service and thereby, you know, reaching even more people. So that is absolutely beautiful. What I really want to sort of get started with, because I do believe it's the foundation of everything, is breathing. And it's interesting when I looked at your content, it was interesting to me that is something that you emphasize a lot, where, like, if I hear PT, the first thing I think of is not breathing necessarily. You know, you think of like either manual therapy, or you think of, okay, they're going to give you some sort of exercises to do. But I personally don't necessarily consider breathing. So I would love to hear why that's important, number one. Number two, how we as active people can improve our breathing in all areas of life.
It's important because it's the one thing that we do that literally changes the shape of our bodies moment to moment. And so part of having more mobility is having more space. For example, if the room that I'm filming this podcast in right now is extremely small, there's only so many places that I can move. If we push the walls out and made it bigger, there's more places that I can move within the room. That applies to all types of movement. So if we take a joint, for example, that has arthritis, the space structurally is reduced. And over time, that can get uncomfortable. And so it would behoove us some way to create more space. When you breathe, your body literally has to get bigger to make room for the air. And so that's a way of creating space, not just in the lungs, because when you do take a breath of air in, the guts have to move downwards. That changes what's going on within the pelvic floor. Then the rib cage has to move in all directions. That serves as the foundation to the neck, the shoulder blade, things of that nature. And so if you can use that breathing in a manner that allows you to bias motion where you act, where you need it, you can get a much more systemic effect with mobility exercises. And so when I have someone who comes to see me for, either a pain problem or a mobility problem or a performance problem, it allows us to condense the number of activities we need to do that focus on gaining mobility, flexibility to just only a couple or three things. Instead of 10 mobility drills for all the joints that you got problems with, we might be able to do two moves and hit it all. And so it's very time saving. And then we can also use some of the principles of the breath into our training. So that way we're making sure that we load the areas that we need to load, because your body still has to be able to create and maintain space under those circumstances. It's why when you lift really heavy, you do Valsalva. Why is that? Because you take a big breath of air in, that air takes up space, and then you brace and you exhale to create more pressure. So it allows you to essentially have greater pressure generating capabilities, but also be more stable when you're lifting something heavy. And so the power of the breath is something that affects all aspects of movement.
Really, really clear and precise explanation. I love it. I think it makes like thinking of it in a three-dimensional sense. It's so obvious the way that you're explaining it. Now, if I think of myself and many of the women that I work with as well, we have a lot to deal with in our day-to-day lives, and I personally carry a lot of my quote unquote stress in my shoulders, in my upper spine, in my thoracic spine, and just generally like tensing up in that way. So from what I hear or believe I hear you say is that not just exercises, but also with my breath, I can work against that or against like for alleviation of that. How would I go about that? If I were to come to you and just say like, hey, I'm so tense in my shoulders, what can I do about that through my breath?
I always like to ask when someone tells me that is, well, why would that strategy be useful? Well, if you're stressed, your body is going to use various physiological responses to deal with that stress. So elevating your heart rate is an example of that, because that allows more blood to get to the tissues. You might feel more anxious because maybe that allows you to perform at a higher level than you would if you were just relaxing. You need to move air faster. And so, bigger muscle groups, these are called accessory breathing muscles, oftentimes will increase their activity so you can pull more air in and get more air out quickly. A lot of the muscles within the shoulders and neck are accessory breathing muscles. So, that means moving air beyond just normal resting volumes. And so, if you're more stressed, it's not uncommon for people to have a little bit more muscle activity there. But now you got muscles doing two jobs at once. Not only are they helping you breathe, but you also need them to move. The other thing is, when bigger muscles have more tension in them at rest, they restrict the range of motion across multiple segments, because bigger muscles cross multiple joints. And so they kind of lock a lot of pieces together, and that can get uncomfortable. A lot of times you can reduce the muscle activity by choosing positions that would help you create space or mobility in the areas that are a little bit more tight. And the other thing would be coaching breathing in a manner that doesn't rely on those accessory muscles. So if we talk about the positioning you might use first, a common position one might use to move more air in would be rounding the shoulders and having a forward head, because that makes the airway bigger. It's the same reason why if you were to give someone CPR, they teach you to tip the head back. It's basically the same thing. And so what we would do is reverse engineer that position. So if rounding the shoulders and having the head forward is a problem or leads to more muscle activity in those areas that we don't want, We might go with something where the chest is more parallel, we have the arms somewhat overhead to help reduce the tension within those muscles. Then, from a breathing standpoint, if we know fast, shallow, maximal air in and out is something that would kick those in, well, we would do the exact opposite. So, when I coach people through the breath, I focus more on what's called tidal volume, which is basically moving the amount of air you would at rest. So, the way I coach it is you're only going to move about 75% of your air in and out. Five count, quiet through the nose. Pretend Michael Myers from the Halloween movies is close by, but you got to do this exercise. That's kind of the visual I give. And then the exhale would be the same pace, five count, soft through the mouth, but you make it audible enough that your abdominal muscles can kick in, because if we can get those to kick in a little bit, again, not 10 out of 10, more contraction down low leads to more relaxation up top.
Again, super clear explanation and very, very practical. I truly appreciate that and makes so much sense with the head tilt as well. I never actually connected that with the rounded shoulders as well, or with the space that my body is trying to create for air. So thank you for explaining that. And on the point of pain, I'm someone I sometimes have a harder time taking more rest days rather than getting into the gym. And I know many of the listeners will resonate with that. So I even if I have some niggly body parts or so, I still like going to the gym. And I know I often receive the question, I'm not feeling like I'm feeling a little bit of a, like a pinch here and there in the shoulder or wherever it might be. Should I go and train? What is your opinion on training while in pain, whatever form it might be, if it's through from a training, quote unquote, injury, or from being a little bit sick or something like that, what's your opinion on that?
Well, the bulk of what I do when I'm working with people is I help them train, get stronger without beating themselves up. That's kind of like my MO in life, if anything, is that. And so it's important to train because that has a lot of important benefits from not just a health standpoint, but also pain. The aerobic activity that you might have created during that has a lot of pain relieving effects. If you strengthen certain tissues, that can make you more resilient to other stressors. But if you are pushing past the point of pain in a specific area, as opposed to like muscular discomfort, well, that might become problematic, because when you are lifting weights, you are reducing space. And that's normal because you need that so you can strengthen specific tissues. And so what I typically recommend people do is finding workarounds where they can still find some different positions that they can train that work within the constraints that they have available. An easy example of this that I tell people is if I could take someone and they could only raise their arms, up to about 90 degrees, well, you're probably not going to overhead press, right? Because you just don't have access to that motion. I try to take that to another level. If someone's got limited hip rotation, maybe it's, in one direction. Well, any movement that requires a lot of that rotation is probably going to cause issues if I'm trying to push that to a high level. And so, can we work within someone's constraints in that sense? So, for example, if here's an easy one, if your hips are limited in internal rotation, which is what you need to be able to point your feet forward, well, most lifts then, it probably wouldn't make sense to have your feet pointing straight ahead because you don't have that motion. It would make more sense to work in ranges where you're in a little bit more external rotation. That could be as simple as toeing out a little bit. That could be doing things that have more front foot elevation, for example, in the case of a split squat, because at the bottom of a split squat, that requires a lot of internal rotation. You do front foot elevation, that helps offload that. And so it would be things like that. At the same time, too, things like the warm up or even your accessory moves, so the things towards the end of the program. Those are prime times that we can try to do activities that work on the range of motion restrictions that you might lack. And so I think the people who I see make one of two mistakes. Either the mistake that we talk about, which is they beat themselves up, push through pain, and then hope for the best, because eventually your body's going to get you to shut down. On the flip side, I also get people who don't want to do any form of fitness until their mobility is perfect. But The problem is if you're only working on mobility drills, and then you got to deal with some sort of external force, like, oh, I don't know, walking, sitting for a long period of time. You got to pick up a sandbag somewhere. I don't know. Funny story. I hurt my back doing that. You're not going to be prepared for it. So the best form of training is to gain as much motion as you need and produce the fitness qualities you need to do the things you want to do. And that's why I try to advocate for most people. Now, the other question you asked was, do I push through illness and things like that? Depends on the illness. The rule of if it's kind of neck up in terms of sickness, probably okay. But if you got the full body chills and things like that, that's the one circumstance where rest is usually best.
That's a good little rule of thumb. And I want to dig more into what you said about the hip rotation, especially the internal hip rotation, because I do believe that's something it's most of us are probably insufficient at, or at least not as from all the sitting that we're doing, or simply moving. Let's say we have someone who is used to just doing endurance sports and all they do is like running, or all they do is cycling, or whatever else. So we're just moving in that one plane. I find that people like that often very much lack a hip internal rotation. So my question is, why is this so important, aside from it being functional? And number two, what can we do specifically to help, like what kind of exercises can we do to improve that internal rotation?
So you need both external and internal, and all movements have some element of that. Internal in particular is needed for any time you put force down into the ground. Because when you internally rotate an arm, a leg, any joint, there's a reduction of space within that area. Anytime I'm squeezing muscles, that's force production. So we can see that those things are synonymous. And so if you're limited in that, that might be affecting your force production capabilities in a negative manner. So think most strength stuff, endurance, anything, right? Anything where you gotta do something that requires you to output stuff. And so if we're talking the hips in particular, you have to look at some of the anatomy that are the mechanics that are required, not just at the hip joint, but in all the surrounding joints to produce that. To internally rotate the femur, stuff on the backside, particularly in the lower part of the pelvis, so kind of like near the outlet, which is kind of like the lower part of where the gluteal fold is, right? So if you got a big butt and you got that little lip underneath, that's kind of the area that I'm talking about. So that area needs to be able to relax to produce that motion. And so some activities that you can utilize at lower intensities, and I have to be clear about that, would be things that would be more hinge-like, because when you hinge, you kind of move into a range that requires those things to relax. Other things would be driving internal rotation to more weight-bearing positions. So sometimes what I'll have people do is I'll have them start with their legs really externally rotated in what I would call frog position, and then drive IR from that. That could be on your back into a Swiss ball. That could be pushing into the ground. All of those could also drive the same rotation. In terms of ranges of motion that require internal rotation, aside from that, working in like the middle range of hip flexion. So think like a parallel squat, or plus or minus, half kneeling, bottom of a split squat, all of those require internal rotation. So if you can access those motions again at lower intensity, and you feel things that you should feel, which would be like more muscular effort, not pinching and stuff like that. Those are some of the basic tactics that I use to gain that motion. And then, of course, the breathing strategies that we talked about previously are built within that, because that's what's gonna, when you breathe in, again, as the diaphragm descends, it's gonna push the guts down into the pelvis. The pelvis has to be able to kind of open and close to some extent and change pelvic floor muscle activity and muscle activity in the back of those hips to be able to get that to relax to express that motion.
Yeah, I again would not have thought of the benefits of breathing specifically to help with that internal rotation. So thanks for the reminder on that front. And you mentioned the split squat, and I often find that such a questioned, well, I do think it's highly valued in sort of the fitness space, but I think the recommendations on how to execute it vary so much. Sometimes people say, oh, you should only do it leaning forward so that you're just emphasizing the glute. Other people, oh, no, your torso needs to stay upright, blah, blah. What are some of the common mistakes that we see with split squat, and how shall we execute it correctly?
Well, I think both of those are useful for different reasons. For example, if you talk about the forward pitch, that would access the lower part of the hips, which could possibly get you more internal rotation. And generally, you see that the more weight bearing on the lead leg is required. So, for example, it is normal on a rear foot elevated split squat because when you're doing that, the back leg's lifted, you're more of your body weight's tipped to the front leg. You should pitch forward to some extent. Conversely, let's say we flip that the other way. If I go with a front foot elevated split squat, I am likely to be much more vertical in that position because I have less weight bearing on the lead leg. And so the torso angle changes accordingly. That is going to bias more load into the quads. In the glutes, when those muscles kick in, due to some of the changes that happen within the hips and the pelvis, it actually biases more external rotation. So neither is bad or good. It depends on what you're trying to go for. So if I'm trying to go for one thing, but I'm using the other strategy, well, then it's not a good split squat. In terms of technical things that I see that, regardless of what variation you choose, people screw up. One has to do with the amount of load that's going through the lead leg. If you're someone who's doing a split squat and you feel mostly your back leg working, like the quad is ripping off the bone, you're probably not doing it correctly. And so what you want to make sure is as you do the split squat, you choose a stance that allows you to transfer weight from the back leg to the front. And there's a natural kind of rotation and sway that should happen back and forth between those legs. The other thing that I see is people working in a variation or a range that they don't have access to. And then you see both the legs sweep towards the outside. And so what I mean by that is let's say the left leg is the working leg, so it's the leg in front. A lot of times you might see the left knee move inward and the right leg move outward. What's happening in that case is you're not allowing for the normal rotation of the pelvis and trunk towards the lead leg to happen. Now, that can happen because someone doesn't have access to that motion. So maybe you got to do some things to work on rotation into the left hip. Sometimes, if you go too deep, that can also be a problem. And so, some easy workarounds for that could be making sure that you choose an appropriate position to hold the load. If I hold a weight out in front of me, that'll allow me to shift my weight a little bit more backward. So it gives me a little bit more room to create that forward shift that we're talking about on the split squat. Sometimes holding the weight on the same side as the lead leg, that will limit the rotation going into the le front leg. So that can also be a useful strategy. And then the last one that I see is people locking out way too aggressively at the top. When you lock your knees out, that causes your pelvis to shift more forward. And so, if I'm already moved forward and then I'm doing a position that requires me to move even more forward, usually that's when we see a lot of the funky stuff that I was talking about. And you're relying a little bit more on the connective tissues, you're not loading the musculature as well. And so, these would be the people when they go down, you see a lot of rounding through the back. They're the person who kind of shifts the torso way forward. Just things we don't want that might negatively influence loading in the split squat. For that, you got to make sure that you keep the knees soft, your weight shifted backward first, and then go straight down. If you do those things, a lot of times that can clean up split squats quite a bit.
Yeah, I think those are definitely some of the main mistakes I have seen and probably done myself in the past as well. One more comes to mind, and that would be kind of like a tilting hip, sort of, if you know what I mean. And would that come back to one side being stronger than the other, or not holding the tension properly, or what would cause something like that?
So the most common tilt is you. So let's say again, the left leg's in front would be the left hip hiking up. And so you got to ask, why is that useful? Well, If I do that, it actually allows me to produce more internal rotation. And so you can see that if you take a pelvis and you drive the femur into IR and then you tilt it upwards, it looks like there's more. But it's the same thing as if I were to arch my back to lift my arms overhead. It's an illusion. So that's why that happens. So then you got to look at, does the person have adequate internal rotation on that leg to get in the position? If they don't, you can try all the coaching cues that you want. You probably got to get that space first, or you got to modify. And so you could use some of the activities that we talked about before. Things that I do when I see that is usually I elevate the front leg because that reduces the weight bearing. Sometimes going on a ramp can also help with that as well. So like a downhill ramp on the foot, because that helps shift the weight back also. Which can, again, if I come back a little bit, then I don't have to go as far forward, which requires internal rotation. Also, holding a weight out in front of you can help with that as well. So those would be some of the big things you might see. You also might see that the load's too heavy. So again, I might have to use that sort of behavior to allow me to move myself up that much. And so altering load, the amount of load that you're having within the split squat could also be something. Usually that hip hike is paired with the knee drift that I was talking about before, because you'll almost always see the front knee caving in and the back leg caving out.
No, those are really, really helpful tips. And especially the one with I like the one with the ramp for the front foot. That makes a lot of sense, really. So, I mean, the split squat, obviously a great exercise for the glute as well. And I'm always or many of the ladies also that we work with want to grow their glutes and have stronger glutes for a good reason. But sometimes because of that, we see a very tight performance or tight glute altogether. What are some tips for loosening up that specific area other than, let's say, just a pigeon pose or something like that? How do we work against the tight performance?
Well, it's actually the same strategies we talked about to gain internal rotation. If you look at the function of glute max and piriformis, they're both external rotators of the hip. And so when you externally rotate your hips, that pushes the pelvis forward. And so from an aesthetic standpoint, it makes you look like you got no butt. Right? And I always think of I always see this because I've worked in some rural areas in the U.S. Like it's the dude who comes in, he's a big dude, he's wearing jeans like a farmer or something like that, and his butt is actually his lower back. And so, and if you think about this, it actually comes back to the space piece. If I have those muscles tight at rest, when muscles contract, they reduce the amount of space. So you don't have as much volume back there because these muscles are engaged more. So to increase the space back there, if that's something you aesthetically want, you actually have to get some length back into those tissues. And so anything that promotes internal rotation, which is the exact opposite action of those, would be useful. Sometimes a pigeon stretch could be a way of doing that, is because the way that the position of the piriformis changes when you're at 90 degrees of hip flexion. But I give a lot of the same stuff, hinge-like activities. Maybe you got to do some split squat variations where you have a little bit more of that forward pitch, driving internal rotation. All of those would be tactics to use. And then eventually loading them with a lot of what we know about typical hypertrophy, which would be lots of mechanical tension and volume. And a lot of times you can influence the postural presentation in a manner that allows you to get some of the aesthetic changes that you want. But you can do a lot of basic hypertrophy work, but if your hips are still tucked underneath you, it's going to limit the shape of the glutes unless you address that simultaneously.
Great. Again, great explanation. And to me, it sounds like most of the tight spots that we might have or limitations in terms of range of motion that we have, you and your practice, you like to address with more sort of strengthening and a hypertrophy work as opposed to stretching or as opposed to like passive kind of acquisition of that r extended range of motion. What is that fair to say, or do you kind of pair both? And by stretching, I mean, also work with bands or anything like that.
It really depends. I'm not married to any specific exercise. I want to use things that work. And so sometimes if a person can't access a certain position, let's talk about all those exercises that I did. I have some people who struggle to get into any of those positions. I might need to use a more passive strategy to be able to give me a little bit of real estate to get there. That could be foam rolling in the back of the hips. That could be certain stretches in different positions or more lower level activities. It's like learning any skill. If you want to learn piano, probably not a good choice to start with Beethoven. Right? You want to learn with chopsticks. Same logic with getting into any sort of range of motion you don't have access to. Right? You being able, if you have no internal rotation whatsoever, you doing a max effort rear foot elevated split squat is probably not a good choice because it requires a ton of that. And so what I encourage people to do is know what you need, try something to see if you can get more of that, and then recheck to see if it worked. It's the same thing we do when we're trying to change body composition. You apply some sort of dietary intervention. You wait about 2 weeks. Are we heading in the right direction or not? If we are, cool. Let's do more of that. If we're not, then we need to change something. Same logic with movement.
Great, great parallel there. Absolutely. I have one more, more like, well, exercise or physiology related question, and that pertains to another area that often people are in pain with, and that is kind of like headaches, or again, from the tension, maybe in the neck or the shoulders. I don't know, but how do we, quote unquote, fix headaches, and prevent them or go about them when they happen?
Yeah, headaches are challenging because there can be a lot of possible influences. There's some people who have a genetic predisposition to that, and it depends on the type of headaches. If you're someone who's predisposed to migraines, there might be a component that is not movement related. Same thing with certain cluster headaches. The ones that seem to respond best to movement-based interventions would be tension types, headaches, cervicogenic, which means headaches that originate from the neck. And so many of the strategies that I have talked about before could still work here because neck range of motion, tension within the TMJs, cranium, all that's influenced by things below that area. And so when I'm working with someone on the headache side of things, those are a part of the program. But there's so many other things that you could work on as well. A lot of the things that I've seen influence headaches favorably would be things within the sensory systems of the head, face, all that, and the joints. TMJ is oftentimes can influence headache presentation. So if someone's got limited range of motion, motor control, they have altered muscle activity with muscles of chewing, swallowing, things like that, that can play a massive role. There's a discipline called myofunctional therapy, which is basically like physiotherapy for the tongue. I do a lot of that with patients and clients as well. If you're someone who can't get your tongue up to the roof of your mouth, you can't keep it in between the teeth, you can't get an adequate chew and swallow without thrusting your tongue forward, well, that's going to alter muscle activity in an unfavorable way up in this region and can contribute to tension type headaches. Same thing with the visual system. Your eyes have muscles that attach to them, and there's several movements and skills that they should be able to do. And if there's a lack of that, or if I have a situation where maybe I can't move my eyes out and I keep them in all the time because maybe I'm on screens all day and I'm not looking out into the environment, that can also contribute to problems as well. That's why sometimes, like your best intervention for headaches, aside from making sure you got everything medically cleared, could be working with a dentist or working with an optometrist who specializes in any sort of optometric exercises. That's been very useful. There's probably also some benefits from doing things just to the cranium itself. Now the cranial bones, sutures, all that stuff. It doesn't move a whole lot, but there is some sort of rebound that they should be able to have. And sometimes doing manual cranial work can be useful for that because all of your muscles attach to bones. If you alter the movement, shape, all of that of the bones, sometimes that could be extremely helpful. The last thing I would say with that, again, aside from everything I've talked about and movement stuff related to the body, you want to make sure that the health of your upper airway is in check. If you're someone who's got some sort of sleep disorder of any kind, and there's a compromise within the upper airway, that can have negative influences within pressure generation of the skull and cranium, and that can be a contributing factor to headaches. So it's important to get that looked at as well. And sometimes addressing that component, maybe if someone's got sleep apnea, you get them on a CPAP or you do some sort of oral appliance or anything like that. I've seen some people have some extremely large improvements in migraines and things of that nature by addressing that. So it's a lot of stuff. And that's me not even talking about the medical interventions that can obviously work, like medications and things like that, which there is a place for that, depending on what the influence of the headaches is. So it's a complex problem, but I also think there's so many possible conservative measures that someone can use to address them that should give hope. And it's a matter of applying the logic that we talked about previously. Figure out what are some possible influences, do some things for that, and retest and see if you get an improvement in headaches. And if you are, cool. If not, you got to change something.
Well, Zach, I just love your absolute holistic approach, your individual approach, and really just seeing where the person is at, and instead of saying a one size fits all. So that is very, very clear. And to sort of round things off, I would love to just hear a kind of a brief or broad overview of your Human Matrix seminar for anyone who is interested, or who's, I don't know if you take that around the country or if it's just sort of Vegas centered, but please tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Lisa, I'm actually going to Germany this year. I'll be in
Oh, no way.
Düsseldorf.
Oh, very cool. Well, nice. Hopefully
Yeah, so.
not at this time of the year. So, but
No, it's going to be in July, I think.
oh,
So
very good.
it's going to
You
be good weather.
should have some decent weather then.
So, yeah, I teach my seminar all across the world, to movement professionals, whether you're a coach or a clinician. But I've also had some people who are just movement enthusiasts go to it. Now, there's obviously it's a challenging biomechanics course. However, if there's one thing I pride myself on is trying to make it as simple and practically applicable as possible. And so what you will achieve by coming to the course is you'll be able to see how everything that we've talked about is in a more integrated model. You'll basically be able to see kind of how the sausage is made, so to speak. And then how you can assess for when someone has some sort of movement restrictions, and then learn how to not just coach, but also program for those people so that way they can do the two things that I think people need to be able to do. And that's have enough motion in all of their joints so they stay healthy, and then produce fitness adaptations within the constraints that they have available so they can meet whatever their individual goal is. And with the amount of practical application that I have within the seminar, I'd say a majority of the attendees do a good job of doing that. But also, if that's not your bag, I offer a lot of movement coaching, but with myself and my coaches, where we basically apply that model to yourself so that way you can hit those two goals.
Very, very cool. It honestly sounds super valuable. I love that you're taking it all over the globe. So it must be sought after as well. And yeah, just thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us today. I'm going to make sure to put all your handles in the show notes so people can learn more from you on Instagram or any other platform as well. And I'm just truly grateful for your time today.
Well, thank you, Lisa. This was a really fun conversation.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Zach. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening.